2020 presidential election had the highest turnout since 1900. That was despite being held during a global pandemic. Joe Biden got over 81 million votes, most ever for presidential candidate. Donald Trump got 74 million votes, the second most ever cast for presidential candidate. The results now, the Georgia Senate runoff, means the Democrats control Congress for the first time in a decade, both the House and the Senate by just a whisker. Bills won't just pass the House only to die in the Senate necessarily. And now Joe Biden will take office with still, though, a divided Congress, a divided country, a divided media. How will this division, how will this reality, how will this new government impact progressive policy priorities over the next 2 to 4 years? Right now, we're joined by Laura Williamson, senior policy analyst at progressive think tank Demos, to talk about the path forward for that policy agenda under the new administration and the new Congress. Laura, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Jefferson. It's great to be here.
Since we scheduled this and we had to reschedule, and thank you so much for your flexibility with that, it's almost good news that we did, because over the past 48 hours, not only do we now know the composition of the U.S. Senate, but we also know what's at stake for democracy. What has been the whipsaw of your emotions and your analysis over the past 40? We're recording now, to be clear, the day after. We're on January 7th. That will release it just a little bit after that. But on January 7th, right after the riots at the Capitol, talk about what you were going through during that.
Whipsaw, whiplash is, I think, the right way to describe it. I know most people are sitting with what we saw in the Capitol yesterday, and I am sitting with that and also trying not to lose sight of the Herculean victories that we saw in Georgia just the day before. You talked about the historic turnout in the general in November, and the turnout in Georgia for the two special elections for the Senate are no less historic. You mentioned the extreme circumstances that the voters and the organizers there were facing with COVID. That's only more true, more weeks and months into the winter surge. So I'm sitting with just really sort of some inspiration and some hope by what Black and Brown organizers in Georgia were able to do to turn folks out, and what Black and Brown voters in particular in Georgia were willing to sacrifice to make the statement of their belief in our democracy and the importance of voting. And of course, excitement and inspiration about what that means for our policy agenda in Washington on the Hill. And the other side of that, of course, is that with the violent white supremacist mob attacking our democracy and the peaceful transfer of power yesterday, I think that only underscores the extreme urgency that has always been there, but is, again, only more present today than it was yesterday, for structural democracy reform that helps us build the kind of equitable, accessible, inclusive, and multiracial democracy that would have prevented yesterday and is the appropriate response to yesterday.
Before looking too far forward, let's look a little bit backward. And let's, in fact, look at the lessons that Georgia might teach. You shouted out long-term organizing. My guess is that might even be your first response. But what do you think are the most important lessons that we need to take from the results in Georgia?
I think that's exactly right. Black and Brown organizers in Georgia and elsewhere, but especially in Georgia, we know have been saying for a long time that sustained deep investment in deep organizing and in turning out Black and Brown communities is the key to unlocking a political landscape that will allow us to pursue progressive policies that will benefit everyone, to be clear. And we had the opportunity with Georgia to see that, to have that proof of concept, because of the way that the election shook out, we were just the entire nation's eyes and political apparatus's resources were focused in one place. And they were, rightly focused on the Black and Brown organizers there, who've been on the ground building this infrastructure for years. And we saw what can happen when you make a significant investment in folks who've been on the ground doing the work year after year, cycle after cycle. And we saw, we saw the results of that. We saw we're sending the first Georgians, are sending the first Black Georgian senator to the Senate. And that's, again, incredible in its own right, and also unlocks a whole array of new possibilities in terms of the policies. And so,
The whole world changed with two Senate elections, right? I mean, that's not an overstatement.
That's right. I think that's exactly right. And again, it's not just true in Georgia. We saw it in Arizona with groups like Lucha, Living United for Change in Arizona. We saw it in Wisconsin with groups like BLOC, Black organizers organizing communities, Black leaders organizing for communities, excuse me, and other places across the country this cycle. And again, they're not just doing this for the first time. They've been doing this for cycles and years and years and cycles and cycles. And so I think, again, there are many lessons, but for me, the top line takeaway is investing in organizing led by Black and Brown communities across the country, sort of cycle after cycle, year round.
And paint more of a picture. When you say deep organizing, help people understand what you mean. Investment, I understand. That means donors saying we're not only going to donate to some congressional candidates, and we're not just going to give to longstanding and white-led organizations. We're also going to make large investment scale donations to Black and Brown-led, BIPOC-led organizations on the ground in states. I get that part. Say more about what that deep organizing ends up looking like, right? I mean, people maybe have a view of, I mean, some people going around with clipboards and registering voters. Really means that. What else might it look like?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think that's the idea, is that when an election cycle comes up, you know, when we're in the few months or maybe several months before an election, we go out and we start to knock on doors, etc. But what I'm describing and what organizers in these places have been doing and they've understood for a long time is that you actually have to invest in people and build relationships and build trust and build investment in the system day in and day out, year round. And so that, you know, if you are just showing up a couple of months or, you know, honestly, in some cases, a couple of weeks before an election and asking folks to turn out, that's not going to cut it, especially for communities who have been, I mean, literally written out of our democracy, you know, since the beginning. And obviously, those same communities are those who've pushed our democracy to be more inclusive all along, but who still ultimately have confronted and continue to confront extraordinary barriers to being able to participate and believe that their voices are actually valued, right? You know, showing up and saying, turn out and vote for me because I'm the right candidate for you, I'm better than the alternative, it's not gonna cut it. So what these organizations and organizers have been doing is they've been knocking on doors every day throughout the year and not just saying, you know, vote for this candidate, they've been saying, how are you doing? Like, what are you facing? What do you care about? What are your priorities? What do you want to see change? And then have been actually building campaigns around what they have learned from their communities about their priorities. And some of those are voting rights and democracy related campaigns. You know, others are economic or about education or about healthcare. And so they've been running campaigns that directly respond to what they've heard from their communities. And they've been involving people in those campaigns. And then when they go back and knock on the door around an election and say, hey, you know, we don't have to say, hey, remember us. They, you know, that people open the door and they're like, oh, hey, friend, hey, person who cares about me and is invested in me. And then have just, again, a greater trust in the system and the idea that voting for this person can actually make a difference and make a change. And so, you know, I think you talked about investment, obviously, you know, it looks different based on where you sit and who you are. For an organization like Demos, we sort of live this belief in year-round organizing and support through something called the Inclusive Democracy Project, which is a cohort of Black and Latinx-led grassroots power-building organizations doing the kind of work that I just described across the country. And so we work with those organizations to develop bold policies that meet the needs that they're hearing from their communities and to support their efforts to pass those policies. But again, for other organizations and entities, it'll look different. And certainly we need the kind of financial investments that you described as well from donors and others who can.
Picking up on something else you said earlier about how the eyes of the world were on Georgia. I had said without research that I don't think there'd ever been anything like that, where there'd ever been a pair of Senate races that were on their own day with nothing else on that day, that the control of a chamber of Congress would hinge upon what happened in that election right after a historic presidential vote. Is there any, I don't know if you looked back or anybody, any chat rooms you're in, any listservs you're on that identified any historical analogs that are even close to this? Because I can't think of one.
It's a great question. And I know you often have historians on your show, on your podcast, who would be able to answer that probably better. I do think it feels pretty unique, certainly in recent times. but I'll give that some more thought and get back.
Yeah. And I don't mean to put you on the spot. So maybe we share the same curiosity. I remember Jim Jefford's flip might matter. I mean, there've been times, I know there was a Louisiana race that Louisiana often happens right after, at a different time, but yeah, I can ask somebody else. I heard what you were saying about the, I suspect you might have guest suggestions of others who are involved in the Inclusive Democracy Project and what that looks like. Say more, this is maybe a clumsy question, but say more even about what is at stake for those of us who are, the question I was going to ask is sort of what's an appropriate role for white allies, right? I don't need to lead with that question, but maybe let's stick with where you are at, which is how can we best understand the value and priority in listening to Black and Brown voices in democracy and defining democracy, not only with some vision of Greece or with some vision of white signers of the Declaration of Independence, but a vision of something more like the 21st century?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I feel like I'm going to find myself saying this throughout our conversation, but I think we don't have to look very much beyond what happened yesterday in the Capitol to start to answer that. Because, we had this violent white supremacist mob storming the Capitol, trying unsuccessfully, to be clear, but trying, in a desperate, need to cling to power, trying to undermine our democracy and the peaceful transfer of power. And, with a few exceptions, there were like white folks in my community and on my Twitter feed saying, oh my God, my brain's exploding. This is unprecedented. This is wild. I can't believe it. And I had people of color in my community on my Twitter feed saying, not that surprised, right? And I think about sort of one of the most kind of enlightening moments for me as I sort of understood our democracy and how deeply, deeply racist and white supremacist it is and has always been, was when one of our Inclusive Democracy Project partners kind of caught me. I was talking about how our democracy is broken, our democracy isn't working for all communities. And she said, no, our democracy is working exactly as it was designed. Our democracy was designed for white men and to entrench white male power and to keep everybody else out, and particularly Black and Brown communities. And so I share that, because your question was about kind of what we can learn from the Black and Brown folks, yeah, in our lives and in our work. That was one of the most important lessons for me. And then thinking about yesterday, I mean, if yesterday taught us anything, it is that the white supremacist remnants and roots of our democracy are still alive and well. I mean, it is no accident that this white supremacist mob stormed the Capitol and tried to undermine democracy the day, to undermine the process of the peaceful transfer of power of two people, including one, a Black woman, to the presidency the day after the Black and Brown, largely Black and Brown voters of Georgia, sent the first Black man to the Senate from Georgia. And so we have to be honest about that. We have to learn that history if we don't already know it. And we have to think in terms of democracy reform and the changes, the scale and the scope of the changes that are needed to build an inclusive democracy for the first time. We have to think about that and do that work with that historical sort of grounding and underpinning, with that knowledge about what our democracy has looks like and how it was built. And again, what's needed to actually move us from a place where in 2021, we saw what we saw yesterday, to a place where, we are the day after Georgia, we are celebrating. We are, acknowledging that we've actually made progress and we, are moving closer to an inclusive democracy.
Yeah, that our democracy isn't broken, it's fixed. It's fixed to, the fix is in order to yield certain objectives, and we have to fix it in a different way. We've got to transform or build it. I heard that. And another thing I heard in connecting what I heard you just say and what you were saying just previous, it also occurs to me that it's a lesson of not only, and you made sure to interject, by the way, an unsuccessful attempt to undermine the election, as distinct from a successful attempt at long-term organizing to change the political realities, at least in a state, at least in one election year. And maybe that is in high relief for people who engage in protests, and that can be a a very moral act, but also can see the strategic value of not only protests and certainly not only of riots, which are different things, but also comparing those to the value of long-term strategic deep organizing.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's really astute. You know, what will endure from the last 48 hours is the results of Georgia and the work that went into it. I'm not just saying that there aren't going to be implications from the attempted coup yesterday, but ultimately they failed and Congress certified the results, you know, several hours delayed, but they did certify it. And so I think that's an astute observation, and that's exactly right.
When we originally started talking about talking, we originally scheduled this, the idea is, well, hey, we got a new president going to be elected. Hopefully that president will be seated. We'll see what their U.S. Senate looks like. And with Joe Biden being the nominee, right, a not quite octogenarian white man, very much of the entrenched Democratic Party, right? Not, and he's not, you know, he is not a Democrat in name only. He is not is somebody who tries to cast Joe Biden as, I mean, the way I understand him best is he tries to be kind of where the Democratic Party is, right? And he kind of tries to be a representative of that thing. You are an organization that has values and objectives, that has policy priorities, that has those policy priorities regardless of who happens to sit in the White House. But of course, who sits in the White House impacts the strategic landscape that you face. What's the strategic landscape you face now?
I'm encouraged by it. I mean, I have to say that maybe seems obvious, especially after Georgia. But, you know, for one, we have, you know, we have Biden in the White House, you know, accompanied by Harris, who is obviously a historic vice president, but who also has lived experience that very few previous vice presidents and very few presidents have had, that inform, again, all of the issues that we're talking about, democracy, economic justice, et cetera. So I think that is really encouraging. I mean, people are not everything and we have to focus on policy, but you know, people will say personnel is policy, right? So who's at the very top of leading things in the White House and then who they're putting in place. You know, I'm encouraged by the historic cabinet that they have put in place. And again, a number of folks who are filling that out who have really important expertise and lived experience. We have the most diverse cabinet in history. And then the appointees who are coming in to support those cabinet members are incredibly encouraging as well, including a number of important voting rights and civil rights leaders in the Department of Justice. So I feel really encouraged by the sort of way that the administration is making up the executive branch. And, you know, you pointed out at the outset, we still have a great deal of division in our country and in Congress. And the, I don't remember exactly what you said, right? But the majority in the Senate could not be narrower. But we also have—
Like some would say 50-50 isn't a majority. Some would say it's just a half.
That's right, yeah. But we also have tremendous leaders and new leaders in particular in both the House and the Senate. You know, we haven't even yet gotten to see what the newest senators will look like and bring. But we have folks in the House as well who are brand new, who are coming out swinging and who are coming out without sort of, I think, being beholden to what they're told by the party is politically possible or what's, you know, strategic in terms of fundraising. They're coming out talking about what we actually need. You know, Congressman Jones talking about explicitly and, you know, about Supreme Court reform. You know, we had Congresswoman Bush yesterday sort of in the throes of everything, putting out a resolution about, you know, the need to hold these Republican leaders accountable for stoking this. And so I'm really encouraged. I know that it's still tricky. I mean, we still have to contend with the filibuster in the Senate. You know, nothing is to be taken for granted, but I think with the progressive champions that we have across the federal government now and their sort of boldness and their commitment to being connected to and listening to and fighting for people, real people in their communities, coupled with, again, a really talented and passionate advocacy community, you know, who have been building the case for democracy reform, structural democracy reform for a long time, and particularly over the past couple of years, I feel hopeful.
What hadn't occurred to me just this moment, because all this stuff is happening fast, is that it is said, particularly in legislative bodies, and it's a little different here, but in legislative bodies, it's often said that that when you have split chambers, it tends to give greater power to the executive. The executive ends up playing a larger, not only because of their basic ability to veto, but because they end up having an important informal role of brokering betwixt. Now, there's a little bit different because here Kamala Harris, it provides the 51st vote. So there is essentially an operative Democratic majority for making committees, et cetera, approving cabinet appointees. But even she is a piece of that executive branch. And so now it seems like we will see, and I'm bored by kind of the winners and losers game, and that's not sort of the essence of the dialogue here, but it does seem that this goes to the benefit, this significantly builds the power of the Biden administration and puts much more at stake for what the Biden priorities are, not just him, but the diverse cabinet that you identify, the sort of apparatus that he is elected to lead. With that in mind, one of the big things I want to talk about is what now becomes possible. But rather than just ask that far too broad a question, let's start with a few things you already identified. You said accountability for what happened on January 6th in Washington, D.C. I spoke, it was an hour ago from when we are recording now. It'll be a little bit more before, with a constitutional scholar who's a Republican, no fan of Donald Trump, who thinks there needs to be accountability. And his own analysis and research thinks that the best mechanism would be the 14th Amendment, which says that anybody in the United States who works for insurrection in the United States can, by a simple majority vote in Congress, be barred from ever seeking or serving in federal office. So that could include not only Donald Trump, but potentially Donald Trump's kids, Eric Trump and Donald Trump Jr. And maybe their flip, maybe some of the change in their language is because some lawyer called them and say, you understand this insurrection could bar you ever from, you know, trying to be the future or once again leader of the Republican Party, much less the country. And as you think about what accountability steps might be possible or might be worth considering, what's already occurred to you, what's already been discussed within the discussions you've been having, are those discussions worth having? There'll be people say, oh, no, that's just vindictiveness. How are you processing this at this point?
Yeah. Well, see, I am excited. I mean, I said this at the outset. I am excited for the conversation about kind of what policies we're thinking about, what we're prioritizing, what we're trying to push, because I think that is, we need to think about what happened yesterday. We need to think about accountability. And we also don't want to allow ourselves, as we have over the last 4 years, to get bogged down in Donald Trump's actions at the expense of our own agenda. So just to say, I'm excited to talk about the policy pieces next. But yeah, I mean, I think that I've heard it talked about in terms of the 25th Amendment. The 14th Amendment also seems like a powerful tool. I think Donald Trump remains, I mean, he's always been, we didn't just learn this yesterday, he remains an incredible danger to the Republic and to our people, and particularly to Black and brown people. I was thinking about that here yesterday in DC, of course, but it was also true in state capitals around the country where folks were cropping up, has been true for a long time before yesterday. I think that our elected leaders need to step up and take whatever steps they can, whether it's via impeachment or the 25th Amendment or the 14th Amendment, you know, whatever the tools or the mechanisms are for it. I think it's absolutely, should be a priority. The tricky thing is that there's many, many other priorities, including obviously actual COVID relief and all of the policies that I'm sure we're going to talk about next. But I think that it's absolutely worth putting energy into it because, you know, he will no longer be in office in whatever it is, 15, 13, et cetera, days. But he's, I think, absolutely still a threat after that. So I like the idea of trying to bar him from future office.
In your background, includes, and I think pretty much up top, priorities around voting rights and money in politics. I want to make sure we talk about some of the voting rights issues that are going to come up. Nancy Pelosi has already said it's the top of her priority list is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Also want to talk about Supreme Court reform. Where do you want to start? You'd rather start with Supreme Court reform, voting rights, or COVID? Your call.
Let's start with voting rights, because I think those are likely to be the things that come up and move first, including, of course, H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which has already been introduced. So why don't we start there?
What do you think is possible? What do you and what do you think are the dynamics to getting something? I think back to the first 100 days of the Obama administration. I think back to the fight for healthcare and pushing that and having, you know, a better U.S., a more favorable to the president U.S. Senate. And still the challenges of getting anything passed and the loss of a public option in that back and forth. So I also want to kind of understand the puts and takes. What do you think is possible? Mm-hmm.
I think everything is on the table now. So there are four principal legislative vehicles for structural democracy reform that Demos has, you know, been supporting and in some of the cases working on. And I think all are possible. I mean, I don't want to, you know, be Pollyannish and suggest that it's not going to be really tough and there won't have to be probably some trade-offs or some things that we lose, you know, like the public option, as you said. But we, you know, have to come out starting kind of quite strong. And the good news is that for each of those four bills, we've been doing that work for the last several years, and we do have strong proposals to bring to the table to negotiate with. And so in particular, those are H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which of course is this big transformative structural democracy reform package that would advance the kind of racial equity in our democracy that, you know, that we need, have needed for centuries, that we were talking about earlier. This is policies like, I mean, so there's, stop me if I'm getting too far into the policy.
Let's get it. We would call it democracy surface if what we wanted to do was have democracy surface. Let's get into the tricky stuff. And we did an episode on H.R. 1. It's good to review it, and it's also good to review what's kind of what our concerns are now. I will say I thought it was the best piece of legislation I ever saw. A recent Chamber of Congress pass, right? My fear then, I think I may even have said it then, was looking at what happened in the New York legislature where they passed, I think it was publicly financed elections in one chamber when Republicans controlled the other chamber. And then as soon as Democrats controlled both chambers, they didn't put it forth anymore. When it was when that offered rhetorical strength, heck yes. When it offered transformation, it's like, well, maybe we're a little bit nervous. And I worry about H.R. 1. I even thought it then, well, this is a cool rhetorical device. And Elizabeth Warren would certainly sign such a bill. And I suspect Joe Biden would sign such a bill if it got passed. Do you still think that Democrats will prioritize it now that the threat is real?
I do. And in fact, they've already prioritized it. So they already reintroduced the For the People Act, H.R. 1. And, you know, that was on Monday before Georgia. And so it is, you know, live fire, so to speak now. Right. But they've introduced it and they have continued to commit to passing it quickly. You know, when it passed the House last session, it passed unanimously on the Democratic side. You know, I think there will be a struggle to keep all of those or enough of those Democrats on board. And but folks are doing that work. Like there is a whole apparatus of folks, both federally and I think in the states, who are working to try to, you know, keep this thing together and to make the case for passing it. And I'll say also, you know, there've been improvements to it with the reintroduction. So it's an even stronger package than, you know, what you were thinking about.
Go through some of those. Get into some of those weeds about, you know, what are the most important pieces of the For the People Act, and including some of the changes.
Mm-hmm. So there's three divisions. One deals with voting rights. The next deals with campaign finance reform. And the third is with ethics. Demos is most focused on the voting and the campaign finance reform sections, and although we are enthusiastically supportive of the entire package. In terms of, so the voting section includes a whole slew of really important democracy reforms, voting rights reforms. And so this is everything from automatic voter registration and same day registration, which together would actually do a great deal to reduce the barrier role that registration has played to voting forever, and particularly for Black and Brown communities, by shifting the burden of registration effectively onto the government and creating, you know, making sure that registration deadlines never again serve as a barrier. So those two together are in themselves transformative and are just one piece of H.R. 1. The voting reform section also includes getting rid of discriminatory voter ID laws, banning use it or lose it voter purges, which take people off of the voter rolls for not voting in the past, restoring people's voting rights, post-incarceration. So in a lot of states, people who've been convicted of a felony continue to be denied their fundamental voting rights, even after they've been released through probation and parole, and until they, you know, pay some fines, which is really hard for a lot of folks. So HR 1 would restore folks' voting rights immediately after release. And then in terms of changes, I mean, really importantly, HR 1 last time around had provisions related to voting by mail, but some of the changes that have been made between last time and the reintroduction are taking the lessons from the 2020 election, when of course we saw much expanded use of vote by mail, and improving that section to reflect those and to make sure that vote by mail systems are racially equitable and are more accessible for all types of communities.
How do you do that? What if you don't put an explicit eye to racial justice of vote by mail, what do you end up getting wrong? And how do you adjust that? Or how do you think about it with an eye to racial justice?
Well, so vote by mail is in many places predicated on having
having a stable address.
Right, a residential mailing address. So, you know, some Native communities were some of the first folks to speak up and say, you know, okay, vote by mail, but let's make sure that you don't require somebody has a permanent physical mailing address to be able to access the ballot, because some Native folks living on tribal lands don't have that. And so they said, you know, let's make sure that tribally designated buildings can be used, the addresses of tribally designated buildings can be used for our communities to be able to request ballots or receive ballots. So that's just one example. You know, making sure that you don't have to have a notary sign your ballot, which folks in Alabama and a few other states did have to do this time, which can be inaccessible, particularly if you are...
Yeah, who's a notary? Nobody's finding a notary. Nobody's finding a notary in the middle of a global pandemic, for certain.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's something called community ballot collection, which is a provision of some vote-by-mail programs, which allows community members or friends or family members to collect ballots for their family members or their community members, because they may be home or, you know, living with a disability or sick or whatever it may be, and bring them to them so they can vote them. And then once they voted them and sealed them and signed them, to return them to elections offices or to drop boxes. This is a pretty, in some places has been a controversial practice, because the suggestion is that, you know, there's tampering, et cetera. But in reality, this is a really important sort of piece of systems that allow communities who have a harder time getting to the post office or getting to the drop box to be able to have their ballots turned in. And this is, you know, this is important for Native American communities in particular as well. And so community ballot collection provisions can be important for racial equity in vote by mail as well.
Helpful. As we think about the politics as well as the policy, presumably since you have the House on record voting in favor of it, were there any Republicans that voted yes on HR 1? I thought it was straight party. Well, I thought it was straight party line, which felt really unfortunate.
That's right.
And Democrats lost a few seats, but you'd think even with the changes, Pelosi ought to be able to get something across the House floor, right? That'd be the assumption. It hasn't yet been tested in the U.S. Senate. I got no idea what Joe Manchin thinks about it, right? I literally have no idea. Do we have any early indications of it's one of the reasons why we started having this show is the tragedy that democracy itself, that being pro-access to the ballot, pro-a democracy that is majoritarian in mind, that aims at getting the best ideas to win, that tries to represent actually the fullness of the American experience, the current and future American experience, that discussion itself is now falling in betwixt party lines is, mm-hmm. It feels historically tragic. But let's assume that tragedy persists. Let's assume that past is prologue, that even these riots, even this attempted coup in this nation's capital, were almost a precursor to ready the myrmidons, to ready the Trump Confederates to fight against access pro-democracy bills. What do you imagine then being there? What are your early indications of the dynamics in the U.S. Senate?
I mean, you've probably picked up on this by now, Jefferson, but my bias, my sort of instinct is to be optimistic.
Which I appreciate. After the year 2020, that's what we need. So thank you for your optimistic. So if you're just going to say, well, hope for the best and it's going to be hard, I'm down with that. But anything deeper you want to go, that's great too.
Well, I mean, yeah, it is definitely going to be hard. And again, we have an entire community of folks who have been working, mobilizing towards this and working to ready ourselves for this fight for at least the last couple of years, and really in the civil rights community for decades. And so I feel really, again, hopeful about the combination of the champions we have on the inside in the Hill and then the advocates we have on the outside. And then on top of that, I mean, yes, when HR 1 passed in the last Congress, it was entirely along partisan lines. And again, not to be naive, like democracy, unfortunately, voting rights continues to be has become a partisan issue, although to be clear, it has not always been, right?
No, it was like, but for Republicans back in the day, it wouldn't have happened.
Exactly. But all to say, when it passed along party lines last time around, the 2020 election hadn't happened yet. And all of the sort of just compounded barriers to the ballot box that folks of all races and ethnicities, but particularly Black and Brown folks faced, and the complications to just exercising our fundamental right to vote that we saw in operating in a pandemic. And so I don't know, I have to sort of hope and believe that the lessons and sort of what we saw in terms of how just essential it is to sort of change these policies and get these things right will sort of motivate more folks than perhaps were last time around. Again, I know that sounds like I'm just talking policy and not politics, but
no,
I do think we are operating in a substantively different political environment now, not just because of the change in leadership in the Senate, but because we lived through 2020 together.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's going to be more space to push for support across the aisle. And again, maybe not for HR1 in its present presentation, although that is what we will be fighting for. But, you know, maybe with a few adjustments.
No, and I think, and I'll connect this even to some of the early portions of our discussion today, and thank you for taking the time, why it illustrates further to me the hope that that Black and Brown leadership around issues of democracy presents. So it's not only the ambit of like Larry Lessig and, you know, some like white lawyers. And I say that with no aspersion, that was me too, right? So, and it's a dear friend and someone I admire very much, but I remember the discussions for years. And we say, hey, listen, this campaign finance reform stuff is important. Hey, this voting rights stuff is important. And like, yeah. Talk to me when you're actually going to impact my healthcare. Talk to me if you're actually going to impact the environmental protection I'm trying to enact. Talk to me when you're actually going to talk to me about the minimum wage I'm going to earn or not earn. Talk to me about how you're going to make sure that I'm not just in a cycle of going to prison and so are my children. And his response would be, listen, my issue on democracy is not the most important issue. It's just the first issue. It's HR1 now, right? We got to do that to do the other things. But yeah. Now, and thanks not, I think, to primarily to white leadership, but thanks to the leadership of Black and Brown communities, Stacey Abrams being now a super duper famous example of that, but not the only example, there is now this, it's clearly more important, right? There's now, I don't have to have the same conversations I had 5 years ago or 10 years ago about why issues of democracy itself, voting rights itself are important. Why that's not just the ambit of like a Harvard Law School class, why that's actually or a think tank like Demos, why that's actually the fundamental work if we're going to make democracy work. So I don't think your hopefulness, I don't think you're being Pollyannish. I also think that's, to some degree, that's reading the room. Am I being too Pollyannish?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think, again, you talk sort of in the evolution of sort of a white person's orientation towards democracy. I think it's clear that a lot of Black and Brown people have known for a long time that democracy is issue number one, and that it is undergirding our ability to make progress on everything else, you know, as the folks who've been excluded from it for so long.
They have more power.
Sorry?
And now they have more power.
That's right, yeah. Well, I think so. We have, like, Black and Brown folks have actual more political power in the Congress and in some state houses as well. But also we have an electorate, right? We have a nation of people who, again, have lived through having to risk, in some cases, actually risk their lives to vote during a global pandemic. And again, Black folks in particular have been risking their lives to be able to vote for a long time. But we now have this kind of collective experience of being told by, you know, our state, no, you can't request to vote by absentee and use COVID as an example because I don't want you to vote, right? I mean, that's not what they were told, but that I think was the message that folks got last year that they didn't get probably before. And so, yeah, I think there's I hope more support amongst lawmakers, and there's clearly sort of a groundswell, I think, across the nation of folks who understand that this is an issue that we can't take for granted anymore.
And yeah, and thank you for that clarification, and also a chance for me to offer some. Yeah, I appreciate that. It's not, the dynamic wasn't that, oh, finally Black people started listening to Lawrence Lessig, but rather that if there was a room of white power, right, and that somebody, and I'm picking on Larry, but like, you know, like, and that there'd be some person in white power who was saying, hey, what about democracy? And people say, ah, shut up. But now when the room changes and you have not just John Lewis in that room, right, but, you know, folks who are leading organizations, people who've been doing deep organizing their states for a long time, surrounded not only by a couple of think tanks, but also advocating on behalf of legions of voters, that it changes the power dynamic significantly. It's not only the policy has changed, it's the shape of the room has changed.
That's right. I think that's right. And those are the same folks who have, I think, a better, in my experience, a sort of have been savvier about connecting democracy and voting rights and campaign finance reform to the, you know, quote unquote, bread and butter issues that you're talking about in terms of, you know, minimum wage or education or healthcare or whatever it may be, right? These are the same folks who have the ability to draw the intersections between democracy and all the other issues that are affecting our communities in an incredibly compelling way, and sort of just make that crystallize for people, sort of have aha moments. The Black and Brown organizers that I have worked with in the democracy space do that better than anyone. And again, because that's their lived experience. And so I think that is the sort of element of what you're talking about too, in the changing room.
So we took voting rights first. We've done a pretty deep dive on potential for Supreme Court reform. I guess the politics, and we roughly understand. Are you an advocate for expanding from 9 to 12? Are you an advocate for the move that would allow somebody to say, oh yeah, you get to be a federal judge forever, but maybe cycling through so you don't get to be on the Supreme Court forever? And so that has, you know, you're maybe on the Supreme Court for 12 years or some period of time. Is there a particular Supreme Court reform that Demos is prioritizing?
Yeah, so we haven't taken a firm position on any one specific reform, but we have been very clear that reform is needed, and actually in all likelihood, not just one, but instead sort of a suite of reforms. I mean, just for a little bit of context, I think probably most of your listeners know this, but the courts today, the federal courts, are exceedingly undemocratic and unrepresentative of the nation. I don't have the numbers on the top of my head, but I think it is something like 3/4 of federal judges and justices that are white. And of course our nation is 40% people of color. And it's something like 2/3 that are male. And you know, we have about 50-50 male, female in this country. And so they're the judges and justices who are making decisions in our federal courts do not represent the rich diversity, racial and ethnic diversity of our country. And that is a huge problem. If you talk about sort of the politics of it, again, I don't have the exact numbers, but an overwhelming majority of sitting Supreme Court justices were nominated by Republican presidents, including, you know, two who didn't win the popular vote, or who received fewer votes than their Democratic, you know, opponents. And so we have, again, when we think about the Supreme Court specifically, or the federal judiciary more broadly, it's always been one of the less democratic branches of our government, but has become sort of even less democratic in terms of who has actually chosen the folks who are representing us. And again, has always been not representative of our racial and ethnic diversity. So that's just, I just say that to emphasize kind of the need here and some of the stakes. In terms of the positions, yeah, I mean, Demos supports expanding the Supreme Court. 9, you know, is an arbitrary number. It's been expanded before. There's no reason to believe that it is the right number. We haven't taken a hard, firm stance on a specific number, but we do support expansion. You know, we also find the idea of term limits compelling, though, you know, we think that can't be the only reform, especially considering how stacked and in some cases stolen some of the Supreme Court seats are currently, and how, again, they don't reflect the politics, the will, or the diversity of our country. And then, yeah, I mean, I think some of the sort of rotating judgeships and justiceships is a compelling idea. And then I think we should also be talking about the jurisdiction that the Supreme Court has, and whether we want to make any changes to the kinds of cases that they can hear. And, you know, I'll close by just saying, again, we haven't taken a firm position or advanced a specific set of proposals or endorsements that we, you know, of existing proposals, but we are very supportive of reform and think it needs to be a package given the scale of the problem.
In our last minutes, I recognize that this is not, that now there has been, and thanks significantly, by the way, to the work of Demos, not only the last months, but the last years and years, is some of the policy puts and takes are relatively well thought out, right? I mean, HR1, that didn't get hatched in one lab, right? That was lots of people working on lots of policy ideas for a long time that came together like Voltron to build a, you know, powerful, sort of powerful piece of legislation. And so now it's like, not only democracy policy, it's democracy power. Like, what, not only where the nerds come in, but where the hacks come in, not merely the wonks. And I think about that in a few dimensions. And I have to imagine that people, even people who prioritize, who aren't, and I'm not thinking about, you know, some corporate lobbyists, like, how is this going to impact, you know, my ability to influence the system? But people who want law, who prioritize, right, who prioritize democracy as their first principle, including bending the arc of history towards justice and using democracy as a tool for that. And even those folks can disagree. And I can imagine, on setting aside the policy, but on the politics of it, on a few dimensions. One will be the ease or hardness of passing. This will be a little bit long way around the barn, then you can shoot at what I'm saying or offer me a better way to think about it. The ease and hardness of passing. It seems to me that HR1, particularly some of the elements, feel easier to pass, easier to do than filibuster reform, which might feel easier to do than a Supreme Court reform. And I might flip those latter two. Okay. Feel free to quibble with me on that. The other dimension that I can imagine people looking at it is 2018 risk versus benefit. Okay. There are certain things. So if you do, for instance, if you change the voter landscape, if you can make sure that people who participate in voting better reflect who the country is, you're going to have it more likely that who's in Congress better reflects who the country is, right? So that potentially strengthens the 2018 argument. One could imagine a counter case for a filibuster a little bit, but for Supreme Court reform, I could absolutely imagine a counter case. People saying, hey, listen, this is something that a lot of people are paying attention to. If you expand the court, other people are going to call it packing the court. You can say, no, you packed the court first, but that might impact 2018 in a different way. And another dimension then is sort of a tit for tat risk. If you do that, they're going to do that next. Well, there's a risk. They've kind of been doing that anyway. Heck, they just bombarded the Capitol, right? They just breached the Capitol. But but there's still a risk. Hey, you do filibuster. Great, that's neat for now. But then what happens when Democrats, or if Democrats aren't in charge? What happens to the country if there isn't a filibuster anymore? What additional political consideration elements should people be thinking about, or feel free to push back on any of those? Because I think most of the people who are going to pay attention to this are going to like the idea of having a more majoritarian form of government. If they wouldn't, they'd listen to, I don't know, fascism nerd, but thinking about the political dynamics, you're much closer to it than any of us are.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly some of the pushback Demos and others have gotten when we've talked about things like Supreme Court reform and filibuster reform. But the reality is these institutions are sort of inherently conservative, and they are inherently set up to, checks and balances, right? That's a thing. They're inherently set up for sort of incremental change. And I believe, and Demos believes, that we are in the midst of an existential crisis as a people. And this is not a moment where we can settle exclusively for incremental change. And so, you know, the things like the filibuster have been used, the argument that what happens when, you know, the Republicans are in power again without the filibuster to restrain them. The reality is the filibuster has been used primarily, you know, with a few exceptions, but primarily to to block progress on civil rights and other, you know, other progressive issues that we're talking about throughout its history. I mean, the filibuster is a remnant, a racist remnant of our, you know, our white supremacist founding as a democracy. And the Supreme Court, you know, like if it behooved the Republicans when the time, when their time comes, they will also expand the Supreme Court, you know, whether or not we expanded it first. And so I say both of those things to say, number one, this idea of like democratic restraint right now, disincentivizing Republicans doing whatever they want to do when the time comes, if the time comes, you know, isn't very compelling to me because we've already seen them do that. I mean, if you just think about the, you know, the recent Supreme Court vacancies and then nominations and sort of the hypocrisy there. And so I don't think Demos either finds compelling the idea that we should not do what we need to do now in the face of this existential crisis on democracy, on climate, on economic justice and people's ability to actually just like, not just thrive, but even survive in the midst of COVID and this economic crisis. You know,
yeah, they'll quo whether or not you quid, right? They're gonna do their thing whether or not you do. They're gonna do their thing whether or not you do your thing. I hear that loud and clear. And then the other piece though is what helps build a governing electorate majority, right? Not only what impacts the institutions, but what impacts the electoral majorities that can impact those institutions over time.
That's right. What builds the kind of power in political power in particular and economic power as well in Black and Brown communities that has been denied to them forever, and what our nation could look like once we have that. You know, one of our inclusive democracy partners talks, and Demos too, but she always reminds us, takes us back to this idea of thinking about policies as democracy accelerators, and which policies, how should we sequence the policies that we pass to advance democracy such that then we can pass other policies, because we actually have governing power. How can we actually accelerate democracy through the sequencing of the policies that we do? And so I think that's why structural democracy reform has to be a number one priority, because it, again, everything else is predicated. Our ability to have governing power and political power to pass other policies is predicated on us focusing first on democracy.
That's brilliant. That should probably be the title of the show, unless that would feel dishonest because we didn't think of it until you just said it. But Democracy Accelerator is brilliant. And I mean, of the episode, like that has shaped my thinking and maybe a perfect place for us to wrap. I do hope we can talk again. If there's anything else you want to shout out, please do. Any way people can engage with your work, anything you want to plug, anything I should have asked that I didn't, or final word from you.
Gosh. Well, first and foremost, I want to shout out Charlie Carter, who's the member of our Inclusive Democracy Project, a Black woman, who reminded me of Democracy Accelerators actually just this morning. So she gets that credit.
It's brilliant.
And the things we didn't talk about, you know, we didn't really talk at all about reform and progress at the state and local level. I think that's a thing we would have talked about if we were doing this before this week. But there is continues to be tremendous opportunity at the state and local level. And some of those same leaders that I talked about earlier at the beginning of this episode, members of the Inclusive Democracy Project and others, continue to fight for and win victories on democracy reform in their states and their localities. So just a shout out to them and to that work. And so folks, you know, don't just get sucked into the federal conversation and to focusing on the Hill, but continue to follow and support and engage in state fights.
Would you be down to do a part two where we spend a little more time on the state and local work that now I think like had there not been the result in Georgia, not been, probably we would be talking about is how do you do voting reforms state by state by state? There is a chance that women's suffrage is going to be happening in Congress rather than happening state by state by state, right? To use that historical analog. But yeah, if you'd be willing to do a part two, we'd love it.
That'd be great.
All right.
Yeah. I get more excited and nerdy about state-level democracy reform, so ready.
Likewise. Well, we want to thank you so much, and thank you to Demos for your work, and we hope to have a chance to do it real soon.
Likewise. Thank you, Jefferson, and the whole team at Democracy Nerd. Looking forward to reconnecting.
And Happy New Year.
Likewise. Take care. Cheers.
Democracy Nerd is produced and recorded in X-Ray Studios, thanks to producer Kyle Curtis and Chase Spross. Thanks also to Kat Buckley for the graphics. I'm Jefferson Smith. We are at the beginning of this. Please subscribe, And give us a 5-star review, even if it is only in the hopes that we eventually earn it. Help spread the word. You can check out X-Ray's podcast page, xraypod.com, for past Democracy Nerd episodes and other X-Ray offerings. And thank you, Democracy Nerd.